It's a great lunch, and it's a great memory that you enjoy sharing the time with. We always have that. But the time is now for the introduction of our special speaker, and the sponsor is the vice president of the club and the soon-to-be president-elect, a fellow by the name of David Rismiller. David!
Thank you, Mr. President. Forum Club members, guests, it's a real privilege for me to introduce today's speaker. And John Stumpf became president of Wells Fargo in August 2005, CEO in June 2007, and added the chairman's title in January of this year. He's a short-timer at Wells Fargo. He's only been there 27 years. He began his career with what was then Norwest Bank Corporation, headquartered in Minneapolis. I would say his rise through the ranks to the top job at Wells Fargo is really a story of what one man has achieved, but at the same time, it's a great story of what we can do and what we can do in our country if we have goals and objectives. Now, listen to this. Our speaker is one of 11 kids raised on a farm near Piers, Minnesota. He earned his way through college, obviously, including an MBA from the University of Minnesota. What did I learn about him in visiting with some of his team members? Wells Fargo refers to their employees or associates as team members. I did receive a couple comments from people who wish to remain nameless. He does like to walk, and that may be where he solves his problems and thinks about priorities and challenges and all those other good things. Understand he's musical. I've heard he occasionally bakes bread as a hobby. More importantly, I'm told he's a great speaker, a fun person, an inspirational and excellent leader. Inspirational and excellent leader. I want to mention a couple things about Wells Fargo. Assets ended 2009 of more than $1 trillion. $1 trillion. 279,000 team members, 70 million customers, and I imagine there are a number of you in here that are customers of his company. They have stores, not branches, of 10,500 in the country, ATMs of over 12,000, market cap of over $130 billion. I did check the stock before I left. It was up 30 cents to $27.70-some this morning. Like many of you, I am proud to say I own a few shares of Wells. Not many, but a few. In Florida, they merged Wachovia into Wells Fargo in 2008. In Florida, they have 16,300 team members, over 700 locations. I want to give you some of the awards and some of the things that have been said about them, some accolades. Forbes, top 100 best companies in the world. Fortune, world's 39th most admired company. 2010 rankings released yesterday, and the fifth best in mega bank category. Fifth best. Okay. Next page. I need a couple notes here. Business Week. Top 10 biggest givers in corporate philanthropy. Business Week, best places to launch a career. Tell your kids and grandkids that. I can go on, but I want to move along to get to our speaker. I'll say that during his leadership, Wells Fargo was forced by the U.S. Treasury to accept $25 billion in TARP funds. You may hear about this. Among large banks, Wells has the lowest cost of funds. And during the bank crisis days of recent years, they owned no SIVs, structured investment vehicles. I'm going to give you a quote from a man John and I both know, and I rarely do quotes, rarely use this man's quotes, but I think it says a lot about the bank and about John's leadership. Real insight you get about a banker is how they bank, and what Wells didn't do defines greatness. Warren Buffett quote. I will say as a career banker, I can easily say that Wells is one of the best, if not the best, mega bank that we have in our country today. So please join me in welcoming our speaker, John Stumpf.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Dave, thank you. You read that just like I wrote it.
perfect. What a thrill it is to be here. I got a chance. I've been to this part of the world a number of times, and every time I come back here, I realize how much I miss it. Not only the natural beauty, what God created here, the beach, the sand, but also the goodness of the people who spend time here. So it's so wonderful to be here. Let me tell you a couple quick things about myself and our company, then I want to talk about the economy, because that's probably what you want to hear about. As Dave did mention, I'm one of 11 children. People always ask, well, what'd you raise on this farm? I said, well, kids. So the only thing Dad planted that came up every year was a kid. So, but I do get two serious questions. People always ask me, how many bathrooms did you have in that house? And the answer is we had one. Well, we had one and a half. We had an outhouse. But in northern Minnesota, if you went in that in November, they wouldn't find you until May. So you didn't do that. But the more interesting question that I get is, how many bedrooms did you have in this house? And the answer is we had two bedrooms. My four sisters slept in the north room, and my six brothers and I slept in the south room. And in the south room, it was big enough to fit three double beds. Now just think about that. Those of you who have an accounting background or a math background, you can't divide 3 into 7 very effectively. Two of the beds had 2 in them, and the bed I slept in had 3 in them. So I slept in the middle. I was the oldest boy. My brother Philip slept on my left, and my brother Stephen slept on my right, and that's the way life was. In fact, I never got a chance to sleep alone until I got married. All right, I want to make sure. I don't want to go too fast here. A lot of retirees. But it is an honor to be here. And I don't know about you, but I was inspired by the invocation this morning. I will take all the prayers we can get. Bankers don't get invited out a lot these days. You know, after all, we created the swine flu. We're responsible for the economic downturn, the avian flu, global warming. All those things are accountable to us. But I was also equally inspired by these terrific young people who spoke up here. And I want you to know that I came from a high school that 10% of our high school students went on to college. And I was deep into the bottom third of my high school ranking. And I went and worked at a bakery for a year before I went to college. And my family was also on a food program. We couldn't afford to pay for our school lunches. So there is a world in front of you. Fall in love with reading. Fall in love with education. And you will have nothing that will hold you back. So bless all of you. And thank you. And thank this club for your advocacy here. Wells Fargo is a large company. Actually, you probably don't know this. Wells Fargo started in 1852, and it was started by the same people that started American Express. American Express was the express company east of the Mississippi, and there was a guy named Wells, Henry Wells, William Fargo, were two guys, and they said, we're going to start an express company west of the Mississippi. And the shareholders of American Express says, that'll never work. They said, yeah, I think it will. So they sold their stock and started this company west of the Mississippi in 1852. By 1917, they had 10,000 delivery offices across the country, mostly in the west and the south. And during World War I, the federal government took all the offices away from them. They nationalized those. And they left them one office, their original office at, you know, California Street and Montgomery, are still our same location today. So when we talk about the government being involved in our business, we're a little skittish about that. We've been there once before. But anyway, today with the merger of Wachovia, we do have about 280,000, as Dave mentioned, team members. We're the largest employer of Americans of any bank in the U.S. All of our team members, we have 282,000 team members, 3,000 are overseas. Only 3,000. And they're mostly there because we had to hire And we needed technologists and people who were involved in helping our legacy systems keep operating. We couldn't find the talent here. But our phone banks are here, our bankers are here, and we're an American company, and we believe in America, and we invest in America. We're also the largest bank now in Florida through our acquisition here. We make 1 in 4 mortgages in America. We service 1 in 6 mortgages. We're the largest originator of small business loans, of SBA loans, of middle market loans. We're the largest bank-owned insurance company. I can go along all this largest stuff. But when it comes to customers, I have yet to have a customer or a prospect tell me, I want to bank with Wells Fargo because you're so big, I can be just a number. I never hear that. What I hear from our customers is 4 very simple things. Know me, understand me, help me, and reward me. That's what I hear from them. So even though we're very large, we try very hard to act like a local community bank. We try to think of our desks as a kitchen table where we're sitting around with our customers talking about helping them succeed financially. One of the reasons we didn't get into a lot of the trouble others did is because of our mission statement. Our reason for getting up in the morning, all 281,000 of us, we take a shower, or hopefully take a shower, we come to work, and our mission is to serve customers, help them succeed financially and satisfy their needs. It's not to make money. Making money is the result of what we do. The reason for getting up and the reason for our business is to help customers. And we deal with 1 in 3 Americans. And that's an awesome responsibility. But we also think we have a responsibility to give back to the community. I got an email just 2 days ago. Our 280,000 team members give more of their money to United Way than any other corporation in America. They don't have to. But they understand that by sharing some of their treasure will help those who are less fortunate. We're also the 2nd largest philanthropic organization, even though we're about the 15th largest earner in the country. And the reason we do that last year to a tune of $220 million is because communities do well, we do well. When communities do poorly, we do poorly. And so few companies get that connectivity. And finally, we want to be a great place for our stockholders, provide good returns over long periods of time. Warren Buffett is our largest owner. I happened to be talking to him yesterday on a different topic. I talked to him reasonably often. He's a very interesting and a wonderful human being. He's the best investor the world's ever known, and our company has been one of his largest investments for a long time, and we are honored to have him. Incidentally, I go and have dinner with him from time to time, and he's a fabulous guy. First of all, he salts everything. You know, it salts you. And I said, Warren, you know, all that sodium's not good for you. I said, when's the last time you've been to a doctor? And he said, oh, he said, my health is great. He said, about 15 years ago, he said, though, I went and finally had a colonoscopy. And sure enough, they took out a foot of my colon. He said, I'm fine now. But he said, I went to the hospital with a colon. I came out with a semicolon. That's pretty funny. That's pretty darn funny. And Warren's got lines like that all the time. Let me get to the serious part of the discussion. I want to talk about how do we get into this mess? How could this possibly have happened? I want to talk about where I see us today. And then finally, what does the future look like? How do we get in this mess? I think one of the significant days in this is April of 2000. Most of us don't even remember that. Well, that's a time the dot-com bubble burst. And investors, whether they be on the corporate side or individual side, got sour on stocks. Then 9/11 came a year later, and interest rates went to 50-year lows. And you had all this cheap money, and housing became the asset, the investment du jour. People who could not afford a mortgage or to buy a home until 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, all of a sudden became eligible immediately because interest rates were so low. One of the biggest parts about what you can afford to buy is what the cost of the house is, how much you make, and what the financing costs. Two of those things didn't change, but the third one changed dramatically. Also, you had this cheap money. You had all this interest, this demand for housing, and you had only so much supply. What happens when you have a supply-demand imbalance? People start bidding up the price of real estate. Builders start building faster. New lenders came into the marketplace. Existing lenders ramped it up. And then after everybody that deserved a mortgage got one, we started to create new people. Tell us what you make. And 70% of all mortgages that originated in the subprime area originated by brokers. And we had this dichotomy, this disconnect between risk and reward became the standard. People who originate a mortgage would get paid if a borrower would sign, and they were forever out of the transaction. They got paid. Reward and no risk. Investment banking houses would package this stuff and slice it and dice it in very different ways and sell it off. And they were out of the transaction. Investors around the world and in the United States had cheap money borrowing, and they were investing in these securities because they had AAA ratings, which didn't turn out to be AAA. So we had this big imbalance. So there was an enormous amount of encouragement in lots of sectors, and it's hard to pinpoint any one company, any one organization, any one industry, and blame it on them. There was encouragement by our Fannie and Freddie, the so-called GSEs, the government-sponsored entities. There was encouragement in Congress. There was encouragement by those who were under-regulated or non-regulated. The banks are not innocent in all of this. Everybody, to a lesser or greater extent, played a role. Those who played the greatest role failed. Fannie essentially failed. Freddie essentially failed. You know, the largest SNL in the country, WAMU, essentially failed or did fail. Countrywide essentially failed. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, even Wachovia, the company we bought, was in dire shape when we went and bought them. Not so much because of the capital situation, because of liquidity. People pulled their commercial lines and the deposits really evaporated. So that's really how we got into this. And this is not only a U.S. problem. This is a world problem. In fact, some parts of the world today, and you read about the so-called pigs, Portugal and Spain and Ireland and Italy and Greece are all having challenges now, all part of the EU. So where does that leave us today? Let me give you a couple of facts that you might know, but it'll give you a sense for what happens. When bubbles burst, and there's a big downturn, and this is my third rodeo, but this one's very different. When bubbles burst, what happens, there is fiscal and monetary stimulus that comes in to invigorate the economy, take place for what's happening in the private sector, so there's public sector influences, to get the economy going again. So a lot of cash, a lot of liquidity has come into the system. But yet we're not seeing the jobs that you typically would see at this part in the cycle. And that's a very big challenge for this country. Think about this. Our total national debt is $12.5 to $13 trillion. Our total GDP is about $14 trillion. And why they measure your debt to GDP, one is goods and services, one is what you actually owe, but that's a measurement. But the fiscal budget for 2010 is this. We're going to spend about $3.5 to $3.6 trillion, but yet our revenue is going to only be $2.1 trillion. We're going to add about $1.4 to $1.5 trillion to our national debt just this year. And remember, the debt does not include all of the future entitlement programs that are out there. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all those things. So if you were to take the future and the growth of those, discount those back and put those on your debt also, it would be a very chilling number. So what's happening today is we have this big debt. We have lots of monetary and fiscal stimulus coming in. It's been in now for a few years, and we're not seeing the job growth. That's different than any other one of the downturns that we've experienced in the past. And I have a theory about why that's happening. If you look back to the other big downturns, first of all, this one is not only a national downturn, in many cases, it's a global downturn. Secondly, we went into this downturn with much more consumer and business debt and municipal and state debt than we've ever had in our history. So many consumers, especially through this downturn, are starting to save. We've gone from a spending nation to a savings nation almost overnight. Savings is good, but that big switch, that big change from spending more than you make to savings has been put a big hit on the economy. And recognize we could not continue to do what we've been doing the last 10 years. Families couldn't spend more than they make forever. Cities couldn't. States can't. And the federal government surely can't. Sooner or later, you've got to pay the piper. And as far as paying the piper, today interest rates are so low. Can you imagine what the carry on our debt will be when interest rates moderate and go up? It'll even be more significant. So we've got that. The second issue that's challenging in this downturn as we come out of it, we don't manufacture a lot of stuff in this country anymore. In fact, our manufacturing base is probably half what it was 30 years ago. So what typically happens in downturns, you get this fiscal monetary stimulus, inventories get run down, and then companies start to reinvest. They buy equipment, they build plants, they hire people so they can start to build their inventories as we come out of this. Today, because we don't manufacture as much, we order stuff. We order stuff from overseas to fill our shelves. So that makes it very, very challenging. But the good news is, and let me switch over to where I think what the future will look like. Today in America, there's essentially 150 million workers, people who want to work or work eligible or able. About 15 million are unemployed, 10%. There's probably another 6, 7, 8, 10 million that are underemployed, or students who have chosen to stay in school and not enter the workforce because there's nothing to enter, or people who are later in their careers who are taking severance packages or whatever the case may be because and they're not re-entering the workforce because there's nothing for them to do or it's hard to find a job. So as we look to the future, I think one of the real challenges for our nation is what will the unemployment rate look like in the future? Many economists are saying today we might have to get accustomed to higher unemployment rates for a period of time until we work through the situation. Secondly, my suspicion is there'll be more government involvement in a number of industries and so forth. You're already seeing some of that activity going on, whether it be, healthcare or whether it'll be regulatory reform, and I'll talk a little bit more about regulatory reform, cap and trade and so forth. I think you can expect that. The third thing that I think that the country needs to focus on is what is our next moon? What's the next thing that we're going to rally around as a country? If you think back to 1960 or 61, President Kennedy at the time said, we're going to be on the moon within a decade. And what's lost in all of that is from, you know, 40 or 50 years later, you go back to that time, so much of what we enjoy today, I think, was spurred at that time. It's the young students who became infatuated with the sciences. And it was a can-do kind of thing. And all the spin-off technologies, I think, has had a huge influence in what we know today as, you know, the internet, the Googles, the cell phones, Teflon, you name it. A lot of that came out of the whole idea on the space program. And to me, there are things like the moonshot in front of us. There are still a lot of things that we see as obstacles that are huge opportunities. What if we could rally around as a country self-sufficiency for energy? Instead of sending $700 or $800 billion a year someplace to people, some of those who don't like us very much, what if we invested that in the U.S. so we could have a greener planet and self-sufficiency? Every great society I've ever known and ever read about has strong infrastructure. The Romans did it when they built waterways. The Chinese did it. And we have an infrastructure challenge in this country. Investing back in this country, I think, is critical to our future. Let me conclude by talking a little bit about banking and the regulations going on right now, and then I want to end with a final thought, and I think there's a number of questions. You hear a lot today about regulatory reform. And just so we set the record straight, there are two or three really significant days in my life. One day is, I'll never forget, is October 3rd. It's a day that we agreed to buy Wachovia, which I think is one of the most wonderful things that we've ever had a chance to do in our company. I also remember October 13th. It was a day that I was flying from San Francisco to Charlotte to meet our new relatives. We were getting married, and we hadn't known each other very long. But at the same time, Dick Kovacevich, our now retired chairman, was getting a call from Hank Paulson to show up at the Treasury building, and he was introduced to the concept of TARP, T-A-R-P. I don't like anything that starts with a T anymore. So, but this was an investment, and we were told at the time that the country wanted, the taxpayer and the government wanted to invest $25 billion into our company and eight other companies. And recognize at the time, Wells Fargo had earned $5.4 billion for the first three quarters of 2008. And in 2009, we earned $12.3 billion. In fact, we earned more money last year than any other financial services company in America. In fact, we're the 40th largest bank in the world, and we earned in the top five. So, but we were told that, and you have to consider what happened back those days. We had seen Lehman's bankruptcy on the 15th of September. WaMu had failed. Bear Stearns essentially had, you know, been broken up. Fannie and Freddie were under receivership of the U.S. government. AIG was in big trouble. No one knew how far this was going to go. And we accepted the investment in Wells Fargo because it was good for the country, it was good for the industry, and a strong industry in a strong country benefits Wells Fargo and our customers, and we willingly went along in that basis. A year later, we paid it off with interest, and when you take the value of the warrants and the interest, it's been a very good return to the taxpayer. But I would be the first one to agree, in our industry, there were some players who were either under-regulated or non-regulated, didn't have any regulations at all. And I'm all in favor of a number of the initiatives that Congress and the White House are supporting. And let me give you some examples. Too big to fail. No one should be too big to fail. If we run a company, if I run Wells Fargo to the point where it is failing, failure is a necessary and important part of capitalism and the free enterprise system. And secondly, if we fail, it should not cost the taxpayer. You can't privatize the good stuff the profits and socialize the bad stuff, the losses. It makes no sense. There should be a very clear, there should be a resolution authority. There is for banks. It's called the FDIC. In the case of Wachovia, taxpayer didn't get hurt. You know, we bought them. And, in fact, even the stockholders got something out of that. But in those cases where there has to be a haircut, it should start with the common stockholders. They should get wiped out. Then the preferred stockholders. Then the unsecured creditors. But there should be some resolution authority that can deal with these companies and immediately or almost immediately pay off to the secured creditors or whatever the creditors are the real value and then liquidate it, get rid of the management, and don't make it a problem of the taxpayer. Secondly, there should be some resolution authority. Someone should be in charge of that. There should be a risk, systemic risk regulator. Somebody should add up the beans and say, this is how many SIVs there are, these structured investment vehicles. This is how many CDOs or CLOs or all these other fancy things. Somebody should add those up and say, company A, don't do any more of those. Or if you want to do those, we're going to give you extra regulatory reviews, or you want more capital. We're also in favor of consumer financial protection. We don't think the agency makes any sense, but there's a lot of providers in the consumer space who were never regulated at all, or some who would choose between regular X and Y. If Y was easier, they would pick Y, and they would go away from X. We don't think that makes any sense. So whoever provides products and services to consumers ought to be regulated by someone. They ought to be accountable. And in most cases, the rules were already on the books, but they just chose not to regulate them. So if you are a mortgage broker, if you're a check casher, if you're a payday lender, there ought to be accountable to someone. But here's where we differ from some who are advocating a separate, distinct agency to do that. We already have what they call a prudential regulator, a principal regulator. And we think, like the company I run, is about half retail, half commercial. We have risk in the consumer portfolio. We take charge-offs there. We have risk in the commercial portfolio. We also have a lot of other risks that transcend both businesses. Reputation risk, interest rate risk, operational risk, compliance risk, and management risk. They transcend either one. You can't pull out one business and say, oh, we're going to have a new agency manage that risk, opine on that, separate and distinct from the rest of the company. So we think it really flies in the face of safety and soundness. But we're all in favor of standing with consumers so they know what they buy, they can understand it, and I think that's only good business. And the final thing I'll leave you with, there's something else called preemption. And I don't want to bore you with that, but one of the great things about the United States is that we have a dual banking system. We have state banks that do business wherever they're chartered. We also have national banks. The National Bank Act goes back to Abraham Lincoln. And what it allows is for a company like ours and others to provide products and services to our customers nationwide. In fact, once we get done with the integration, Wachovia will be on one operating system. You can open up an account as a college student, move any place you want in the United States and never change your account again. Just change the address. And if you happen to work in the District of Columbia, live in Virginia, and borrow money in Maryland, it doesn't make any difference. Or if you happen to be spending winters here in Naples and summers in Michigan or Minnesota, it doesn't make any difference. If we lose that preemption for the national banks, each state can have its own rules and enforce their own rules. So we would create 50 different countries out of the United States. We don't think that makes any sense. And we're even willing to say, have a national standard. Have one kind of checking account or one kind of this. Make it the tough standard of all, but make it consistent so customers can benefit from the way our country is set up and buy products and services and move where they want to. Let me end with an optimistic note. And I want to quote Warren Buffett just one more time. He said, if you bet against America, if you have in the past, you lose. And when I spend time with organizations like yours, and I do lots of public speaking, and I get lots of questions, of all the things that are challenging around the world, this is still the greatest country on the planet. People are free. Capital generation is rewarded. The ingenuity, the generosity of this country is unparalleled. I happen to live in San Francisco, and when I look out we have a small co-op apartment, I look out and I have an unobstructed view of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I marvel at that bridge. The colors are different depending on where the light is coming from. It's as awesome in the early morning as it is at night. That bridge was started in 1933, at the height of the Great Depression. It was finished in 1936. There's bridges out there. We just don't see them today. And if that generation could produce a bridge like that, in the future that we saw from that time, just think, this is likely and possibly the next greatest generation. We can take our challenges, and we have many of those, but I think our future is bright. So with that, I'll thank you again for your time and take questions from...
Thank you, John. That was an outstanding program that covers a lot of cases. We have two special... gifts to you. We have a gift of Naples, Florida.
Oh, how wonderful.
That is a high, and also Molko Island.
Oh, wonderful.
I will hold these on them to you.
Okay.
Give them to you present. And David Rissmiller has been handling some top
great
programs
great
for you. Here
thank
you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
good
it.
Good job.
Thank you much. Yep.
Well, again, we have enough questions that we can go till 6 o'clock tonight. And probably, maybe we'll only go to 4 or 3, but seriously. Fortunately, we have a lot of questions, and also fortunately, I think John has already answered some of the questions, including some things about regulation, particularly where he sees our economy going, some of the problems, including Fannie and Freddie. So I'm trying to stay away from things I feel he's answered to get to some of the others. And first, an easy one. You were in charge of placing Wachovia into Wells Fargo and making that transition. We still see the Wachovia name here, and there's an interest in when you are planning to change the name, and then somebody that's interested in dollars and cents is about how much are you going to spend on name changes?
Okay. Well, we're going to take 3 years to do this. We're now in our sophomore year. We plan on graduating as juniors. So the first year was dominated by putting people in the right places, getting to know each other's organization, starting to work on some of the plumbing and wiring, which is by far the most difficult part of a merger. This year will be dominated by converting our overlapping markets. There are 5 big overlapping markets, Texas and California being the 2 largest. So we will do those, and those are the markets where you have both Wells customers and Wells stores and Wachovia customers, Wachovia stores in the same market. It's very confusing. And the third year, we'll be changing the names across the East. And I think Florida, for example, is scheduled sometime, I don't know the exact date, but probably mid-next year, but it all will carry the Wells Fargo moniker. And as far as costs, we had originally thought the cost of the merger would be about $8 billion. And today we think it's going to be about $5 billion. And we will get saves, annual saves, because of the merger of about $5 billion annually. So those are the numbers.
Question from a student.
Yeah.
Do you think that in the future it will be difficult for low-income high school students to attend college because of the economy and the debt? And how do you think this, if that's true, how do you think this might be fixed?
Well, I think it is. And as you maybe know, banks have participated for years in the student lending business. We offer both private student loans and we offer loans through the federal government. We're now being invited out of that business. And the government will do it themselves, and there is a belief that there are savings to be had there and it can be more efficient. I don't know if I agree or disagree. I don't know if I bought the business. But I think that if you look at the cost of education, it continues to rise faster than the rate of inflation. So I think that is a real issue. I know in my case, when I went to college, I worked at a bakery for a year after high school. And when I went, my dad and mom said, geez, send us a note. Let us know how it goes. You know, so I financed my own. And there's probably going to be more of that in the future.
Here's a question similar to a number of questions around the same issue. Are banks lending, is loan demand good or fair, if it's not good, why?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question. I should have addressed that. There is this feeling. In fact, I went and saw the president twice last year with other bankers, and I met with him as recently as last December in the Roosevelt Room, and we talked about lending. And there is this perception that banks aren't making loans. I think the biggest risk to our industry for the next couple of years is finding good earning assets. Because consumers are deleveraging. Many companies are not building inventories or buying things. And so we've actually put a system in our bank to do a second look at any turned down loan. If we look at the approval rates of our small business and business banking businesses, which were the largest in the country, our approval rates are back where they were before the downturn, back to 2006 levels. But the applications, the number of deals we look at, are less than half. So that is the deal. But I do hear, I still hear that when I'm out speaking to YPO groups and so forth, I keep hearing that. And I said, give me an example. And sometimes the examples are, well, I could have gotten this kind of loan 3 years ago with nothing down, no personal guarantee. And I said, well, yeah, good luck. those aren't around anymore. So I think there's more of that difference than, but earning assets, we have lots of liquidity we'd love to employ. We just simply can't find the loans today.
We have several of our members that have suggested with 2012 coming, you should consider throwing your hat in the ring. and at the same time, the questions come, if you were president of the United States today, what programs might you consider both to maybe improve employment, lending, as we've already talked about, home building, the whole real estate market, but sure. It's a whole myriad of questions along the same line if you were president of the United States.
Well, I'm I'm not qualified, and but let me say this. I've had a chance to meet with this president twice and many members of the administration. While people can agree with a policy or a position, I know for a fact this president is trying his level best. His administration's trying their level best. And all hands are on deck trying to figure out how to get our economy growing again. One of the things about government is, there's this idea that government creates jobs. And I almost come at it from a perspective that government creates the environment where small businesses and medium-sized businesses create jobs, and consumers do that. And you want a government that provides clarity and confidence so then people will make those investments. And I think that's really the trick here, so we can get everybody going the same direction so we can get this economy going again.
Several questions about the company you purchased in Florida by the name of Wachovia, and they really come down to the real estate loans that you have inherited, both on the residential side as well as the jumbo mortgage side, residential as well as the commercial. And what are your plans to try and maybe palm some of those off or whatever your plans to try and do something.
We'd ask for each one of you to buy a home from us here as we leave today. And at the time of the merger, we wrote off $41 billion of loans. And I know these are big numbers, but think of it. They had about $800 billion loan portfolio. We wrote off 5% right off the bat. And we said that we thought there'd be another $19 or $20 billion of losses we'd have to take over time. And the good news is, even though the economy from October of 2008 has not gotten better, in fact, it's gotten worse in some cases, those loss numbers are still very much in the same zip code we thought they were at the time. One of the big loss categories was this option ARM portfolio that was purchased as part of the Golden West acquisition out west. And about two-thirds of that portfolio is in California. And we've gotten somewhat fortunate in that housing, especially in the low end in California, has sure found the bottom. In fact, it's probably off the bottom a bit. So we've been helped there. But no question, Florida still is struggling. I was in Miami last week, and the good news is some of the properties are starting to move. The bad news, they're moving at really, in some cases, very low prices and so forth. So, I think we're slowly, as a country, starting to get through this uneven. Better in some states, not as well in other states.
We're running a little out of time here, but we have so many good questions. I hate to quit. We could easily go on for at least another hour. It's like one of Warren Buffett's annual meetings. It goes on all day. So many questions on regulation. Do we have too much, too little? You've touched on that. But at the same time, do you feel that the Fed should be given more authority as far as regulation of not only banks but non-banks of all different kinds?
Wow.
You want to touch on that? Well, I had several, so they don't have to. It's not one person. I have several questions similar
to
this.
The Federal Reserve has a lot of supporters and detractors. And instead of wading into this, our company works closely with the Fed. We also work very closely with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. They're both primary regulators. And, of course, the FDIC is also involved. But whether the Fed gets more authority or less authority, I'm a bit indifferent. I'd rather have a position and policy where everybody gets regulated, and if there is trouble, there is a resolution authority, whether it be the Fed or someone else.
Oh, yeah, that's not good. I agree. Thank you. How about one last question? And here I'd like to let's think about what Wells Fargo is today, and you're the chairman as well as the president, so you're doing both things. You're looking at what the future is as well as day-to-day operations. So what's your vision for Wells Fargo as we go through the years ahead?
Thank you. It's probably a good place to end. the company, I view my role at the company as... Well, first of all, it's a wonderful company. I love our culture, our vision, and our values. And I think we are squarely based around customers, serving our mass market, our wealth management clients. We have all the commercial businesses. And again, we think about our four constituencies, our team members, our customers, our shareholders, and our communities. And I view my role here is to lead this organization and leave it in better shape than I found it. And we very much view this as a long-term deal. I mean, we have almost 160 years of history. And decisions that are difficult for a lot of others, making short-term earnings versus long-term, if there's a short-term, long-term challenge in my mind, it's easy. It's always go long-term because that's how we think of ourselves. And I think that the company will continue to build out certain businesses. We love the insurance distribution business. I like the wealth management business as two businesses that we can even do more in. Today here in Florida, even though the state's having the challenges, we continue to build stores. We hire bankers. And we continue to invest in the U.S. So I think our future is bright because I really do think that America's future is also bright as we get through some of our challenges. Thank you much.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you in 2 weeks and another again in another 2 weeks. See you then. Goodbye.